I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, an openly transgender athlete is hoping for a spot on the U.S. track and field team for this summer's Olympics. We'll talk about the dilemma that that is posing for the athlete and for the sport. We'll speak with Sports Illustrated writer and barbershop regular Pablo Torre about this, about the rules of sports and what they mean for a transgender person. But we want to turn first from the sports field to the schoolhouse. Even though summer is usually a time for vacation and play, that won't be the case for about 16% of Indiana's third graders. Last March, the state of Indiana rolled out a statewide standardized test that measures the reading abilities of third graders. Most passed, but the ones who didn't have to retake it this summer. And if they fail a second time, state officials say that they will likely be held back in the third grade. The rule is new in Indiana, but other states like Florida have been testing third graders with similar consequences for some time now. In a few minutes, we'll talk to NPR national correspondent Tovia Smith about the national picture. But first, we want to go to Indiana, where we are joined by Kyle Stokes. He is a reporter for State Impact Indiana. That's a collaboration between member station WFIU, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and NPR. He's with us from Bloomington, Indiana. Kyle, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here, Michelle.
So briefly, how did this come about?
Well, I think the touchstone for all of this has been that Florida policy, which has been on the books there for about a decade. Really, in 2010, Indiana had a big turnover in the legislature. A Republican-led legislature came in, and we also have a Republican state superintendent, and this was one of the first to-dos on their list. So they passed this law back in 2010 that basically said, we want to make reading instruction in third grade and in the early years of elementary school a real focus of our education policy. And as it was implemented in 2011 by the executive agency that controls education in the state, what sort of came out of it was this test called the iRead 3. As you mentioned, this test that has a lot of stakes riding on it. Obviously, it has the potential to hold back students. But it sort of came from the idea we have to put a focus on reading in third grade, and we have to send a signal to the state schools that this is the most important thing in those early years.
So you can understand the logic. A lot of people say, you know, third grade is kind of this pivotal point. If you're not reading at grade level by third grade, it has huge implications down the line that you fall behind and you can't catch up. But the downside of this is what, Kyle? Because I understand you interviewed a student and you want to tell a little bit more about that. So what's the downside of this?
Absolutely. It obviously comes, it's a very tough love message to say that retention is the way that we're going to handle this. And it leads to a lot of really tough situations. You mentioned a student that I spoke to. His name is Ethan Brown, and he's a third grader who's in Franklin, Indiana, which is just outside of Indianapolis. And Ethan did not pass this past March by just about 3 points. He got a 443 on a test where you're supposed to have a 446 to pass. And this is something that none of his teachers say that they saw coming. And now he's sort of faced with this possibility that he could be retained if he doesn't pass a retake of the exam in June. And so he's kind of been working frantically to catch up with his teachers and with his mom, who are just sort of working the best they can through this situation.
But I think the gist of the interview is there are people questioning whether this tough love approach does more harm than good. So let's just hear a little bit of the tape of you interviewing this young boy who failed, and along with his mom. First, we're going to hear the boy, then we're going to hear his mom. We're also going to hear you. Here it is.
I started crying, telling myself I was stupid because I didn't pass that test.
Really? You said you were stupid?
Yeah, because just for one test, I didn't pass the third grade. I said I didn't pass the third grade. I told my mom that. They said if you don't pass this test, you have to do the third grade all over again.
It breaks my heart that my child thinks he's stupid because of one test. It does. It really hurts me. It's just not fair. It's not fair to a 9-year-old to have to feel that way about passing or even having just to worry about failing.
Just for a point of clarification, you said that it isn't one test. You get two bites of the apple. So that's not exactly right. But on the other hand, here is Stephanie Sample, whom you also interviewed. She's a spokesperson for the Indiana Department of Education. This is what she had to say.
It gives them a tool they never have to go to our parents and say, look, we've always known this kid can't read. Now we've got something that can prove that your kid can't read. What we think the best recommendation is for this kid to stay in the third grade classroom because that's where we can provide him the instruction he really needs.
So, Kyle, what about that? Do you have a sense of which of these scenarios people in Indiana, the parents, the stakeholders, think is really true?
It's so hard to say because it depends on how broad your scope is when you're looking at the policy. I think if you look at the very narrow idea of retention, the idea that you hold a student back as late as third grade is something that really just fundamentally rubs teachers the wrong way. I haven't talked to a teacher yet who said that this makes sense based on the research that I've been exposed to, based on the practices that I've done in the past. And the idea is that retention really has been proven to, on its own, not really work all that well. But on the other hand, I think there's a whole other group of evidence that, again, sort of clusters around this policy in Florida that looks at how really reading scores in fourth grade there have shot up. And these reading scores, the needle doesn't move on these reading scores that much. And so seeing the gains in Florida and saying, you know, with these past retention studies, we weren't comparing apples to apples. Maybe what we're doing when we're building a reading policy that says we have this tough love approach in third grade, maybe we're building in some of the remediation, trying to build in some of the fix of the problem and not just holding students back and hoping that one more run through the wash is going to take out the stubborn stain. I feel like there's a whole other group of people that says we're actually doing a whole lot more on the second time through. And the potential is this could really help out a student like Ethan. He could be the exact student who benefits from this kind of a policy. That's a possibility, too.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. That was State Impact Indiana reporter Kyle Stokes. Joining us now for a national look is Tovia Smith. She's a national correspondent for NPR. Welcome to you, Tovia. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
Well, Kyle's just presented a very interesting scenario here, very much kind of a mixed bag of data. But is there a lot of interest around the country in doing what Florida has been doing and what Indiana is now starting to do? Are you seeing this elsewhere?
There is. Oklahoma, Arizona also passed similar requirements, and others are considering it. And you can understand the interest because basically everybody agrees that reading is not where it should be for these kids and that this is a pivotal point, as you say, where kids move from learning to read to reading to learn. And so the reasoning goes, if kids don't have basic skills by the end of third grade, let's just keep them there until they get the skills and they can move on. And while some have criticized this whole kind of read or flunk idea as punitive or mean-spirited, as you mentioned, those who are pushing it say it's actually the opposite, that it's just waving kids on when they're not ready is what's mean, because you're setting those kids up for failure, and keeping them back, they say, is giving kids the extra time they need to actually have a shot at being successful.
You heard Kyle say that the data is kind of mixed on this, that people are seeing different results in different places. Tovia, could you just talk a little bit more about that, of what research that you've looked at shows on this question?
Right. The data, most of the focus is on Florida. That's had this for about a decade. And that shows that kids who repeat third grade do show improvement in fourth, but those gains tend to taper off in the longer term. So critics look at that and they say, you know, duh, of course kids are going to do better after they've had a whole extra year of instruction and they're a year older. The real question is, how do kids do compared to how they would have done if they didn't stay back? And that's a tough one to answer. There's one study out of Chicago suggesting that there was no gain. And also, there's this growing batch of research focused on the downside of retention that's basically backing up what you heard in Kyle's conversation with Ethan, who talks about how devastating it all was. There are studies that show that there is real damage socially, emotionally. Kids who are retained end up more likely to drop out, and teachers and parents lower their expectations of them. And so there is this mounting evidence that the idea does more harm than good.
What about the test itself, Tovia? You know, in recent years, you know, we've seen various tests litigated all the way to the United States Supreme Court when they had large consequences. You know, tests, for example, that dictate promotions in jobs for adults, you know, or academic tests that are very persuasive in college admissions. What about the tests itself? Are people asking, you know, what does the test really measure, and is it really a good test?
Absolutely. There's a lot of concern around that, especially for kids this young. You know, kids will know what's on the line. There are a lot of kids who might be good readers who might well, just kind of crack under the pressure of it all and not do well on the test. And there are some states that build in a little bit of wiggle room here, so a kid who fails can essentially appeal it by getting a portfolio of his work or her work, and the principal becomes the judge as to whether the kid is ready to move on. There's some argument that that weakens the law, but, you know, my takeaway from all this is the one expert who said there's very little research on this, and both sides are overstating the very little research that there is. And that might not be unique to this situation, but I think it's a fair assessment that the research is not quite conclusive on this one.
Kyle, we want to turn back to you briefly. You've been following the third graders who might have to retake the third grade. And I just wanted to ask, how are they doing? What are you seeing with these students?
We're just getting into this summer month as school gets ready to let out here. And now these students face kind of this slog through summer to get to the retake that starts on June 13th. They have until July 28th. There's kind of a window where you can take that test. I mean, these are students who, I mean, Ethan put off summer plans. He was going to spend summer in Florida with his grandma, and he sort of had to put this off. And I think that, you know, they're going at this with as much gusto as they can. And I think teachers that you talk to will say, we're very confident about how this turns out. About 3,000 or 4,000 of the students who did not pass are within 16 points of passing, very, very close to that finish line. And I think a lot of the teachers are really confident that they can push those kids over that finish line and get them there. It's not going to be great to lose part of your summer for a kid like Ethan. But again, you get back to this sort of debate as to whether or not this could be the best or most pivotal summer in his academic career, or if this is just something that, again, is viewed as sort of a punitive measure. But teachers are really confident that they can sort of push as many over that finish line.
State Impact Indiana reporter Kyle Stokes joined us from member station WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. We also heard from NPR national correspondent Tovia Smith. She was with us from Boston. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks,
thank you, Michelle.
Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a lot of adults are intimidated by the intense anti-gay rhetoric of demonstrators from the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas. So what do you think happened when a 9-year-old decided to speak out against them? We'll tell you in a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about gender and sports and a question that is facing officials who are preparing for the Summer Olympics. In a world where athletic competition is segregated by sex for reasons of fairness, where do transgender athletes fit in? Take, for example, Keelan Godsey, the first openly transgender contender for the American Olympic team. Last month, Keelan qualified for the women's track and field Olympic trials in the hammer throw. Keelan was born female, but identifies as a male and, in fact, lives as a male when he is not competing. However, Keelan competes in the female division. We wanted to talk more about this, so we called Pablo Torre. He is a reporter for Sports Illustrated. Of course, he's one of our regular contributors to our Barbershop Roundtable. He co-wrote a piece about transgender athletes for the current issue. Pablo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
So talk a little bit more about Keelan. Why does Keelan compete as a woman when he lives as a man in every other part of his life?
Yeah, I think this is the most thorny question, maybe. How could you call yourself a man and yet be able to compete as a woman? And for Keelan, it's a matter of identity. You know, Keelan's identity was formed as a women's sports athlete before Keelan came out as transgender male. And the reality is, for a lot of college athletes who are transgender, they have scholarships, they have spots on their teams in elite sports, and they're physically that gender, physically female, for example, in Keelan's case. And really, that's enough for a governing body, or at least it should be enough. The fact that there is no physical transition, there is no difference between Keelan, physically or medically, between him and a biological woman. And so for Keelan, it's a matter of choosing and fulfilling that other part of their identity as an elite athlete.
Does the Olympic Committee actually have rules in place about this? I think many people might remember, you know, the South African runner who is a woman, identifies as a woman, but who had such a masculine appearance that some of her competitors were complaining. And this was actually a very difficult and emotional episode. So are there rules governing how this is to be handled?
Yeah, competitive equity when it comes to transgender athletes is really, you know, the third rail of the topic, specifically males competing as females because of that physical advantage that comes from being a man. Caster Semenya, the South African runner you just mentioned, is intersex. So a lot of the similar issues in that nexus of gender in sports, but for transgender athletes in particular, dealing with that disjointed agreement between body and mind, gender and sex, there are rules. And the IOC was actually the first in 2004 to really come out with a comprehensive codified policy that acknowledged and welcomed transgender athletes. The problem is that the requirements that the IOC laid out involved not only hormone therapy, meaning if you're a male, you take estrogen and you suppress testosterone, and if you're a female, you take testosterone to boost that male competitive athletic advantage that we just talked about. But for them, they also require surgery, just physical, cosmetic differences, changes to genitalia. And so that's the big hurdle, and that's something the NCAA actually, just in the last year, has been able to legislate away. They only require hormones, isolating that as the big differentiator between the male and female genders when it comes to competitive elite athletic sports.
Well, what does that mean in Keelan's case? I mean, as I understand it, Keelan has not undergone hormone therapy and certainly has not undergone gender reassignment surgery. Is that why he is eligible, even though he lives as a man, is eligible to compete as a woman?
Exactly.
So you have to forego the kinds of therapies that would support your transition to another gender if you want to compete at that level. Is that the issue?
Exactly. If you want to stay within your birth sex athletically, you need to forego testosterone, which is really the big thing. Testosterone is the thing that gives rise to so many of a man's physical athletic advantages. And Keelan, you know, let's make no mistake about this. This has been incredibly tough and at times tormenting and torturous for Keelan Godsey, a person who identifies fully as a male and wishes to live as a male in all walks of life. But it's this passion for sports and the opportunity to make the Olympic team in the sport that he has competed as since, you know, for years now. That's the thing that's on the other side of the Olympic rainbow, as it were. As soon as Olympic contention is done, as soon as the Olympic trials are over, or fingers crossed, the London Games are over, Keelan will be taking testosterone and physically transitioning, he told us in Sports Illustrated. And that's, you know, this other second dream beyond Olympic contention that Keelan hopes to finally fulfill.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the dilemma of the transgender athlete with Sports Illustrated writer Pablo Torre. He recently wrote a piece about this. So are there more transgender athletes than we know about? I mean, having a rule in place since 2004 suggests that there are more gender-related inquiries than perhaps the general public is aware of.
The NCAA told us that since 2006, there have been about 40 inquiries from athletes and their attorneys asking about what rules are in place for trans athletes. And you have elite athletes saying that they speak to over 100 world-class level athletes around the world. And certainly you've had a steady stream of athletes, Keelan Godsey being one, Kai Alams, the transgender, first openly transgender Division I athlete to come out at George Washington on the women's basketball team in 2009 was another big data point. But certainly you have an increasing number of people who are coming out, and that's, one hopes, is because of a little shift in culture. You know, we're very far away from where we need to be in terms of tolerance and acknowledgement that transgender people and transgender athletes exist. But there are more of them coming out, it seems, year over year. And one hopes that's because they feel more comfortable and they're seeing these governing bodies actually acknowledge them in the actual bylaws of the sport.
Let's take it from a different direction then, since we are talking about a relatively rare situation. I mean, first of all, competing at an elite level is a relatively rare circumstance anyway. So, and then you're taking people who are transgender within that very small subset. Yep. What is the big deal if you assume that no one is taking a substance or a drug that would enhance his or her performance? What's the big deal?
I think there are two things to keep in mind. Number one is the impact of a single transgender athlete on a college campus or in a sport or on a team is so explosive. And we've seen that with Kai Alams, for example.
Yeah, tell me about that. How so?
Kai came out as a man and was on the women's basketball team at George Washington, a starter, a pretty good player. came out in season, and really the entire team was flooded with transgender talk, media inquiries. The coach was overwhelmed, he told us. And really, you know, the teammates, there became this very awkward dynamic where teammates said they wished that Kai had not come out till after graduation. The coach, Mike Bozeman, told us that he wished that a sports psychologist had come in earlier rather than later. It's just one of those issues that is such a lightning rod for discussion that just the presence of one can really upend a team and athletic program.
Well, so what?
It's not handled directly.
Let me ask you this, but so
sure.
What? I mean, Jackie Robinson upended the Brooklyn Dodgers and the fans and was an object, you know, had to deal with a lot of stuff.
Exactly.
But if there is no argument being made that these athletes have a competitive advantage over other athletes, and it can be demonstrated that they don't, an unfair advantage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I have to ask, what's the big deal?
Let's just talk about what happens when you have a transgender athlete coming out. I mean, what we're talking about is a civil rights issue on principle. It's the idea of finding a space for somebody who has the right to identify as whatever gender they wish and making sure that they're accommodated in the way that any other normal, quote-unquote, athlete should be. And that's just something that structurally and on principle isn't in place yet. And it's something that awareness has yet to catch up with. It's something that you need to be able to be prepared for when it happens.
And on the other hand, let's look at it from a different direction. On the other hand, that the window in which an elite athlete is going to compete is relatively short. Okay. So is there an argument to be made about why can't you just wait until your playing days are over?
Yeah. I mean,
what about that argument?
And that's something that every transgender athlete has heard. The problem is that we need to recognize how tough it is to suppress who you are. You talk to a transgender athlete, there's a reason, for example, why you look at surveys of levels of victimization, levels of bullying, levels of discrimination, and just thoughts of suicide on the fact that they can't express who they are. And that's something that's incredibly, incredibly tough. And that was something that I was, you know, I was really moved by when talking to transgender athletes personally, which was they want to be able to express themselves in some way. Sports is not built to accommodate somebody who fits outside of the traditional gender binary. That's just the fact of how sports was segregated, and that's why it is that way.
Before we let you go, how is Keelan preparing for the Olympics, and how are – I assume he – I'm calling him he, even though he's competing as a woman in the women's division because he prefers to live as a man. So how is he doing, and what are his chances? Is he a top contender? Is he going to make the team is, I guess, my question.
Keelan has a real shot. He finally hit the minimum qualifying mark last month in May. And really, you know, it's a top three finish and you go to London. There's a tough field, but Keelan really has a shot. And God knows that if Keelan were to make the Olympic team, that would be the biggest moment, a watershed moment, more than anything else in the history of sports and transgender athletes.
Pablo Torre is a reporter for Sports Illustrated. He wrote about transgender athletes in the latest issue, which is on newsstands now. Of course, he's a regular in our Barbershop Roundtable, and he was with us from our bureau in New York. Pablo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Every now and again, we like to tell you more about an image or video that's captured public attention. Today, we want to talk about a photo. It's an image of a protest and a counter-protest. For years, members of the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas, have shown up at public events, including military funerals, to spread their message that God is punishing America for the sin of homosexuality. They carry signs with slogans such as God hates America and God hates homosexuals, although on that sign, they very often use a derogatory term that we are not going to repeat. Well, after seeing these signs in these protests, Joseph Miles, a Topeka 9-year-old, decided to make his own sign with the message, God hates no one. He stood next to a Westboro demonstrator and his mom posted a photo on Facebook. Well, to date, NPR's blog post about this has been shared on Facebook more than 100,000 times, and that doesn't even count all the other ways social media users are passing it around. So we wanted to talk more about this, so we've called Joseph Miles and his mom, Patty Akrush. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
All right.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Patty, let me start with you. You've been seeing these demonstrators for some time now. Do I have that right?
Yes.
How long have you been seeing them?
Well, I have lived in Topeka since late 2005. So just about 7 years.
So almost as long as Joseph's been around.
Yes.
Yeah, you've been seeing them. And do you see them a lot? Are they there all the time?
They are. They picket many places that you really wouldn't expect. I don't know what the rhyme or reason is for them to pick it where they do, but they're everywhere.
And has Joseph been asking questions about them? What were some of his questions?
Well, the one that was very hard for me as a parent was, Mom, what is a...
It's not a nice word. It's like the N-word.
It's a hate word. It's meant to hurt people.
And you explained it, kind of.
Yes, I did explain it. Mm-hmm. I told him it's when a man loves a man or a woman loves a woman. And Joseph said, you don't mean like when a brother loves his brother, do you? And I said, no, I don't mean it like that. I think Joe kind of had an idea of what I was trying to say, mm-hmm. if that makes sense at all.
Sure. So, Joe, can I ask you, what made you want to make your own sign?
Well, the reason is because I just don't like seeing those signs, and I kind of wanted to put a stop to that. I didn't want everybody to think that Topeka has a bad image, so that's what made me do it.
How did you come up with what to put on your sign?
I thought about it for a minute, and then I came up with God hates no one, because that is true.
What was it like standing out there?
I felt really brave and confident.
Well, that's good. Well, Patty, Mom, what about you? I mean, I'm assuming Joe raised
the
idea. Yeah,
I was worried.
Yeah, that was kind of my question.
did I really just tell him we could do this? You know, I'd like to clear something up.
Sure.
It's been touted that it was a counter-protest, and that's not accurate. Joseph was making a statement. He wasn't protesting the Westboro Baptist Church. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, when you went out there, how did it go? Were they nice? Were they not nice?
They were respectful, and I have to say that they did not bother us.
Well, Patty, what do you make of the fact that so many people have responded to the photo?
It's odd to me because I guess it doesn't seem like we did anything, really. Joe wanted to make a statement, and that's what he did, and we all can make a statement and make a difference like that.
Joe, I don't know if your mom's told you, I'm sure she has, that a lot of people really like what you did, and they are, you know, talking about it, and a lot of people are sending it around. And we were saying just on our site, more than 100,000 people have viewed it. And I just wonder, what do you think about that?
I didn't think that it would be all this popular. I thought it would just be like, wow, that's really great. Good for you. And I didn't think it would be, like, really popular. I thought it would be kind of popular, but not too popular. Okay, now I'm confusing myself.
Okay. Well, Mom, before we let you go, you said on your Facebook posting that you got your early Mother's Day present. And feel proud?
Oh, he makes me proud every day. He's a kind boy, and it's a privilege and honor to be his mom. I have better conversations with this boy than I do most adults. I learn something new from him every day, and I'm just really glad that he's my son.
Well, thank you for joining us.
And we'd just like to say thanks for all the support for everybody that has sent me messages and have praised Joe and have told me that I'm, you know, doing it right. We really appreciate that.
Joseph Miles recently got a lot of attention online when a photo of him holding the sign God Hates No One went viral. He and his mom, Patty Akrush, both joined us from Topeka, Kansas. Joseph, Patty, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and all this month we've been talking with people who trace their heritage to that part of the world and who are what we call game changers, people who've made a difference in various fields, from politics to science to culture. Today we hear from a woman who's changing the game in business, Laura Sen. As the head of BJ's Wholesale Club, Sen not only regularly hits the lists of most powerful women in business, it's also that she's done it her way, bringing an inclusive management style, something that's improved morale and the bottom line, all this at a company that once fired her. And Laura Sen is with us now. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations on all your success.
Thank you for having me and for those very kind words.
Can we talk a little bit about your background? Your mom is Irish American and your dad was Chinese American, and this is at a time when biracial marriages were not as common as they are now. I was just wondering, when you grew up, when you were growing up in the suburbs of Massachusetts, did you feel there was something different about your family? Did you ever have any sense of standing out in any way?
You know, I would tell you that your perception is absolutely accurate. When my mom and dad married in 1953, it was a pretty big scandal, to the point where folks who were not invited to the wedding went to the church to see this happening. So that's pretty crazy if you think about it, you know, how normal interracial marriage is today. But it was the 50s. It was the McCarthy era. I think there was a lot of distrust around, you know, forget about race to race, but even ethnic group to ethnic group. If, you know, Irish didn't marry Irish and Italians didn't marry Italian. So it's nice to know we've come a long way from there. But growing up, I guess the way I like to tell the story is my mother really wanted us to be the best we could be. As a result, the three children in my family, and we were born in quick succession, my brother's a year older than I am, and my sister's a year younger than I am, we were all really top students and good performers and good athletes and well-liked, and that kind of trumps prejudice, I think.
Hmm. Did you have any discussions with your dad, or did he ever talk about his heritage in a way that made you feel you had something to live up to? And the reason I'm mentioning this, of course, I know you're familiar with the Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, which is one of those books that's just become a big topic of conversation in some circles this year. And the author, Amy Chua, who's a professor of law at Yale, raised in a similar part of the country, also talks about just the sense of you've got to be number one. You've just got to do it. It's not an option. And I just wondered if that was part of your upbringing as well.
I would say it was, but of course my mom was not the Chinese parent in the family. It was my dad. In fact, my father was born in this country in 1913, and his parents came over before 1900, which is also quite unusual. So he was very Americanized, but I think perhaps he had the instinct to marry a tiger mom because my mother was all of that and more. You know, she really wanted us to do well. And, you know, it was never a burden. It was always, you know, just the expectation was a welcome one as far as I was concerned.
How'd you get interested in business, especially retail?
Well, it's funny. I was a French major, a romance language major in college, and I really did not have a clear understanding of what I wanted to do. The economy was very tough when I came out of college in 1978. And, you know, like most young women, I liked to shop. And when an opportunity in working in a department store came along, it seemed pretty appealing. Little did I know how much I would love it.
What do you love about it?
Well, what I like to say about retailing is it is the perfect blend of art and science. And on the science end, it's quite quantitative. We have reams of data, and it's important to use the data to understand your business, understand consumer trends, understand the financials, understand all about what you're doing. And I grew up in the business during the time when the use of data, the use of computers, the use of automation was growing exponentially in retailing and, of course, in all kinds of business. So for me, that held enormous appeal to be able to use data to run my business. But the art side of it is it's about people and products and what they want. And every day we learn something new about what our members want, and we have to respond to that because we know we've seen many retailers who become less relevant, and customers move on to the retailers they find to be more relevant. So that's a really fun challenge. I also love the fact that, you know, there's about over 24,000 team members at BJ's, And leading a group of people that large is a humbling thing. It's a huge responsibility, and it's a huge challenge.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Laura Sen. She's our latest conversation in our Game Changers series. We're talking with Game Changers to recognize Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. Laura Sen is the president and CEO of BJ's Wholesale Club. You know, everybody who's written about you in the business press has talked about your management style, you know, and for building relationships with people at every level within the organization, also with vendors. You spend a lot of time visiting BJ stores. You eat in the company cafeteria. You're known to be accessible. I was wondering how you developed that style, and also whether you ever, particularly as a woman of color, ever worried that people would mistake your friendliness for weakness. You know, because we've sometimes seen where women sometimes seem to feel that they have to overcompensate so that people take them seriously, if I can make that generalization. But I think understood that sometimes occurs. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think, at the risk of being contrarian, the challenge is to not wear your stripes in such a way that people won't talk to you and won't confide in you and won't tell you what they know, because what they know is so valuable. So when I speak with team members, one of the things I like to say is, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to change this business to make it better? And then I always joke with them and I say, because I do have a magic wand. And they always laugh. But it's true, because I just feel like team members are less likely to be frank and candid if they think you're some power figure up on a pedestal or whatever. Then you're one of them trying to figure out how to do this business better, and they really care about what they do and want to hear about what they do and what they know.
How did you arrive at that philosophy?
I'm a really practical person. I think hard about what works, and I think that's what works. You know, I don't see what the value in being someone that is intimidating or unapproachable or aloof. I don't know where the win is in that.
You know, your rise, as we mentioned, to the top of BJ's was not without obstacles. You know, it's well known that you had worked there for more than a decade when you were actually forced out in 2003. You know, for a lot of people, that would be it. But then you came back to a very warm welcome, as I understand it. I'm just wondering, what is the lesson in that? Is there one that you couldn't pass on to other folks?
Well, the first thing I would say is that, you know, the world is round. You always run into people or companies or, you know, institutions again and again. And with the global economy, it's even more so. Some folks, actually, when I was asked to leave the company, encouraged me to be litigious about it. And I just had no stomach for that at all. And I often look back in that and say, if I hadn't done what I consider taking the high road, I wouldn't be where I am today. So I think in the end, if you do the right thing, if you take the high road, it's not always easy, but it's always the right thing, right?
Is there anything that you would point to, either in your heritage, in your various identities, that you kind of pass on to your children as a roadmap for the way they should proceed? I mean, they're growing up, or they have grown up in a different world, right?
My favorite story is not about anything professional. It's about philanthropy. So my Chinese relatives, and, you know, this is at the risk of insulting anyone who thinks I'm putting a stereotype out there, but my Chinese relatives like to gamble. My dad liked to go to the dog track, and they would always, you know, go together. In fact, I have an aunt and uncle who met during the Depression, assembling enough coins to make a $2 bet. So that's how they met each other, and they ended up getting married. So that's, you know, it was something they had fun doing. So when they gambled and they went to the track, and when they were too old to go to the track and they played poker or whatever they did, and they won money, it was the tradition for them. And they always told me this: when you win some money, you give some away. So they'd give me some money, you know, maybe a dollar or something, because that will bring you more good luck. And I have to say that in my experience in being very philanthropic, I've always found that I get way more. I get way more back than I ever give. And I think that that's a lesson that I've taught my children, and hopefully they will carry that on.
Finally, before we let you go, is there any advice you'd give for people who would like to enjoy the success that you've had in business. I don't know necessarily specifically retailing, and I just wonder if there's any advice or wisdom you would pass on to someone who's looking at you and would like to follow in your footsteps.
Well, I think that the tool that we all have at our disposal and the tool that is most important to use in forging relationships, in finding solutions and to move along in the career ladder is communication. And I think that it's so important to think about what the other person is saying and listen hard, to think really hard about what you're saying and how to present that point of view. And the better you develop your communication skills, the more successful I feel you'll be. And I think that leads into a much bigger idea of emotional intelligence and relationships and how that is where, you know, you will be at the next level or not be at the next level. I just think that that's really important. So I sometimes like to say I'm the Barbara Walters. You know, she asked the question that everybody wants to ask, but nobody else will. And if you ask that question in the right way, everybody sort of says, she put it out there. She talked about that thing that we really need to talk about. I think you have to be brave, right? And be confident and know that what's the worst thing that can happen? They'll say, you know, we'd rather not talk about that right now. I think it's all in how it's said. But I feel that communication is the tool that everyone has at their disposal to, you know, make themselves more important in the right way.
Laura Sen is the president and CEO of BJ's Wholesale Club. She's a game changer, and she was kind enough to join us from Boston, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Michelle.
And now it's time for the feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we talk with some of our guests about the music they love. Today we hear the personal playlist of British actor Dev Patel. He's best known for his role in Slumdog Millionaire, of course, but more recently starred in The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. Here's the music that inspires him on and off screen.
Hey guys, my name's Dev Patel, and I play a character called Sonny in the movie Best Exotic Marigold Hotel.
You may write me down in a history. Your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me down in the very dirt, and still like the dust I'll rise.
So what's in my ear at the moment is a song called I'll Rise by Ben Harper.
So you may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, and I'll rise, I'll rise, I'll rise, rise.
I recently found out it's based on a famous poem by Maya Angelou. It's a really kind of inspirational get up on your feet kind of song, so give it a listen.
I'll rise, I'll rise, rise, rise.
Come on and talk to me, I will try my utmost to be honest with you. Try to be honest with you every single word. Come on and talk to me, I will try my utmost to be rhythmical. Try to be...
Another song that I'm listening to is Come On Talk, and it's by an artist called Bernhoft. He's pretty much unknown, but he's amazing live. He does these great performances using this device called the Jam Man, or it's a kind of looping device which where he can record his voice and it plays back and he can overlap different sounds. It's really interesting, so catch his stuff, it's great.
Come on and talk. I've been thinking a lot since the end of our family affair, but the things that went wrong in a manner of speaking, I should have been more forthcoming about the things I needed to say.
My third song is by Bill Withers, Use Me. I think it's a classic, and there's not much that needs to be said about that.
My friends feel it's their appointed duty. They keep trying to tell me
And my last song is by an artist called Emily Sande, and it's called Next to Me is the song.
You won't find them drinking on the table, rolling dice and staying out till three. You won't ever find him being faithful. You will find him, you'll find him next to me.
She in my eyes, is like the new Adele. She's got an amazing voice, great diction, and she's a real soulful artist from my neck of the woods in the UK, and I think you guys should hear the song next to me. She's amazing.
That was actor Dev Patel of the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel telling us what's playing in his ear. To hear my previous conversation with him, please go to npr.org and click on the program tab for Tell Me More. Everyone has lost their heads around us. You will find him, you'll find him next to me. Next to me. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bridget Armstrong, Freddie Boswell, Bridget DeShagas, Andrew Limbaugh, Sanaj Meshkinpour, Amitha Parasher, Jessica Reedy, Amy Ta, and Kenya Young. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery and Ahmad Omar. Our special thanks to NPR's librarians. Our director is Arjun Hutchins. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. She had a hand this week from Emily Oxenschlager. The technical director is Neil Tevold. He had a hand this week from Sean Phillips. Our special thanks to engineering supervisor Kevin Langley. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. Our executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember, to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.